From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2000, Mark Hogenkamp was so brutally beaten by five men that he was left with no memory. Besides relearning to walk and talk and to write, Hogenkamp imagined a new past. He built a detailed miniature town where he acts out World War II-era storylines using dolls. And then he photographs them. The vignettes follow his alter ego, Hoagie, a pilot who lands near the imaginary Belgian town of Marwenkall.
I came flying over in my P-40 Warhawk on fire. And I saw a flat field down below and I crash landed it.
That is Mark Hogenkamp from the documentary Marwenkall. In his story, Nazis swept the town, leaving behind 27 Barbie doll-like women.
I was thinking, boy, what a lucky guy I am. So they gave me my own place, my own building, which I turned into a bar.
It was my guest David Noggle who first encouraged Hogenkamp to share those realistic photos beyond his small upstate New York town. That led to an art magazine publication, gallery shows, the documentary, and now Welcome to Marwen, a Hollywood film starring Steve Carell as Hogenkamp, along with Janelle Monáe, Leslie Mann, and Diana Kruger as his characters come to life.
I got beaten within an inch of my life for no reason.
One foot in front of the other. You got it, Mark.
Embrace the pain.
But I've created a world where I can heal.
What is all of this?
Welcome to Marwen.
And it opens in theaters across the country this weekend. David Noggle is now an Atlanta-based photographer and director, and he's head of R&D Studios, a content creator. And he continues to have a knack for finding reclusive artists. David, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Virginia.
Well, you and your wife were living in rural New York State when you first noticed Mark Hogenkamp. What was your first impression?
Well, I saw him a couple of times. You know, it was extremely rural, so we didn't really see a lot of people around. And I would see him walking up and down the street occasionally, riding either his bicycle or dressed in World War II regalia. And he would appear to be carrying something or dragging something behind or with a stick. And I was really curious about what was going on. So I had to pull over and stop to talk to him.
And what was he dragging behind him?
Let's see. Well, probably the third time I saw him, I actually drove by and took a quick still just to see what was going on. And it appeared to be not a remote control car or something, but it was a 1/6 scale G.I. Joe Jeep. And it was filled with characters.
And how did you first talk to him?
Well, I pulled up ahead strategically and let him sort of walk up on me. And there was a pond nearby, so I was taking photos there. And I just started a conversation and said, tell me about your Jeep. You know, what's going on? He told me that they're all based on characters that he has in this little town called Marwenkall. And they're people, they're friends and family and people he works with. And that led to other conversations.
Did you get a glimpse of Marwenkall at that point?
I did not. I was kind of I was trying to figure out what his motivation was. And I was really struck by the fact that he said, you know, I take photos of these people, my characters in 1/6 scale, and just to show people that I know, that I work with, the realism and how, you know, what an amazing likeness it is.
So he shared those photographs with you. Can you describe what this town looked like?
Yeah, it was kind of hard to tell because, you know, I told him where I lived. I still had no idea where he lived. I would just see him walking down this rural road. And he dropped this envelope in my mailbox with about 25 photos. You could not tell it was 1/6 scale, first of all, because of the depth of field and the eye line. He basically set up these compositions. It looked like you were there. He would hide the seams of the plastic molding. You couldn't see the outbuilding in the background. It was just, there were so many little elements that were strategically placed, just like a DP, that made it so believable that I could not believe these were dolls.
So he's got a church, he's got a shop, he's got a bar called the Ruined Stocking.
That's correct.
You can see snow in these road signs. What kind of scenes were going on inside of them?
Oh, wow. Well, the bar was the first piece, the first structure he started working on. And he said, you know, I always wanted to have my own bar, and this was a chance for me to have it. And I was going to be there managing things. I'm always there. I'm always present, which is a big deal for him. And he also said there was not going to be any danger. You know, I wanted to protect everybody. This is a safe place. And then he proceeded to build additional buildings on the property to keep the bar company, as he says.
Well, so Marwenkall is called Marwen in the Hollywood feature film. But in Jeff Malmberg's documentary, Marwin Call, we see Mark Hogan Camp. He lives in this, you know, jam-packed trailer, chain-smoking all the time. And he works at the Anchorage. There's a bar. He makes meatball sweeps and cleans up a few hours a week. And we meet some of his colleagues and neighbors who he has also created alter egos for. Here is Hogan Camp describing why.
Everybody at one time or another wishes they had a double that could do the things that they could never do. So what I do is, with alter egos, I tell my friends, you can be anybody you want, you can do anything you want in my town. Have as many girls as you want. I only have 27 Barbies, so we gotta keep enough for the other dudes.
Mark also made an alter ego of you. He made one of his mom, the neighbor he has a crush on. What do people in town think of this, and is it maybe different for women?
Sure it is. You know, that's an interesting line to point out. He would bring in these photographs that he'd set up, the same similar photographs that he'd shared with me, and a lot of them were of some of the waitresses or the hostesses at the restaurant that he worked at. You know, they didn't know quite how to take it. Like, he wanted to talk about, hey, you know, I've brought you to life, and it looks just like you, and look what you did, and this is how you're a bigger part of Marwin Call. And he wanted to actually post these in the back of the kitchen. And they said, I just don't feel like that's appropriate. Hmm. That should be pictures of our family and friends. And his reply was, well, these are my friends. This is my family. This is what I know.
So is there a distinction here for him between fantasy and reality? I mean, he's describing in Marwin Call a doll, Anna.
So who's that?
Anna. That's Anna. My favorite female doll. I wish that you would come alive. I won a photo contest, and with that money, I bought Anna.
When I first got the doll, I fell in love with her face, so much that I had to paint makeup on her.
And being that I'm alone in life, I figure, well, at least my alter ego can have a girlfriend.
I wish you'd come alive. He lays her down in a little bed with three other dolls every night and, you know, says, I love you at the end of the night. What's going on for him?
Well, you know, I talked to him recently, and he says that he still puts them to sleep, and he gives them all kisses, and he says, I love you. And, you know, when you're talking to him about it, or you hear his description of these dolls, he'll pause and say, you know, look, I'm not crazy, you know. These are my friends. This is my family. This is my immediate connection.
Well, you've spent a lot of time with him. Did you ever look at him acting out these scenes of Nazis coming and sweeping in a town and torturing Hoagie, his character, in a church? Five Nazis, by the way, and there were five teenagers who did kick his head in, as he says. Did you ever think he is crazy?
Well, you know, he had to figure out his own way of helping himself. After the attack, New York State disability sort of ran its course, and he still felt like he needed his creativity back. So he kind of created his own rehabilitation, where he would do things like engineer and put these towns together with only manual screwdrivers and not using any power tools. Mm-hmm. And he wanted it to all be really authentic, and it was just his way of, like, doing multiple things at one time.
The level of detail is absolutely amazing. He shows a little tiny gun, you know, that has a clip.
Everything's real. The slide on the 45, the hammer, the clip even comes out. So that adds to my, you know, ferocity of getting into it, you know, into the story, because I know everything works. I almost know what every satchel's carrying, you know, that's grenades, you know. And here we have money, the detonator, and then certificate of ownership that I made up myself for my doll figure to carry around, because this proves I own the bar then.
It really is something to behold. But what do we know of him before the attack?
He kept extensive journals and a lot of sketches, and he was really a great artist, had a really great hand, and was very descriptive of his words. And it's just these really capturing the anguish of a lot of his depression and some battles with alcoholism. But he basically had these as a reference to go back and try and figure out, God, what kind of guy was I? Because he had lost all memory of even being previously married. He had lost memory of what a great artist he was and what it felt like to be close to someone.
Welcome to Marwin opens in theaters this weekend, and in it, Steve Carell stars as Mark Hogenkamp, a man who rehabilitated himself after a violent attack by making a miniature World War II-era town. And my guest is Atlanta-based photographer and content creator David Noggle, who helped get Hogenkamp's photos of this town published. He does say, and there's transcripts or recordings of the attackers saying that they beat him up because he was a cross-dresser.
Since I can't remember what happened in the bar, what led them to beat me up, I was told that I told them I was a cross-dresser. I believe they attacked me because I mentioned that I was a cross-dresser.
He no longer drinks anymore, but once he was out of a coma, he discovered that there were 280 pair of women's shoes. Well, what does this part play in his fantasy life?
You know, that's really hard to say. And in the documentary Marwin Call, it's a big shift in the plot. And that was something that, you know, when I met the filmmaker, I wanted to have his trust. This was something that needed to be handled carefully, was not to be made as a freak, as a cartoon character, and I wanted to make sure he was going to handle that with care, and he did. As far as any nuances of cross-dressing within Marwin Call, it's not really there. It's a little more vague.
At one point he talks about, well, let's hear, sneaking a pair of tights underneath his character.
Two or three times I put tights under his pants just to see how that felt, and I was like, no, I'm still, you know, I don't want to come out of the closet in my town yet, but my girls, they know me better than I know me.
Well, I've seen photos of market openings wearing women's shoes and pantyhose, so his secret is pretty much out. You met him and saw him and said, this man's an artist. His work should be out there, and helped connect him with Todd Lippy. This is Esopus magazine. It's a beautiful art magazine. What was the concern for you, however, that, you know, such a fragile man would be exposed?
Well, Esopus magazine is an amazing publication, and I had contributed to them before, and I thought this would be great content for them. And I really wanted the work to speak for itself. I didn't want to give a whole lot of background and context into the nuances of his personality, because I felt like that wasn't really part of the imagery at first. That sort of grew and became more of a part of his character.
Mm. And how has Mark dealt with the attention? You know, and now movie, has it changed his life?
Oh, Virginia, that's a great question. I actually called him on Friday, and it's amazing to hear him sound the exact same. I mean, he sounds the exact same in the same rapport that we have when I interviewed him 13 years ago. He's still doing the same thing. He's still creating. He still lives in the same place. The place looks the exact same. He still smokes like a chimney. And he's still creating, and that's part of my wish, is I wanted for him to be able to sustain a career as an artist, and people respect him.
Mm. We should add that we were forbidden to speak with him contractually because of the studio. You know, he's got this big movie out right now. But your role, I'm curious about, you know, discovery is a very problematic term because obviously he existed before you met him. But you knew publishers, you had access to the art world. And now, you know, this movie has been made and there's a new book coming out and there's a major show in the works. What do you think your role is in sharing his work?
Wow. From the very beginning, I did feel responsible, just because I had shared this with a bigger magazine. And of course, I had no idea this was ever going to snowball and come to where it is. And so his best interest, you know, being able to have his privacy and to be able to express himself and to share his art was always everyone's number one priority. And he's decided to watch the film by himself. He was invited to a lot of screenings. And even Robert Zemeckis, the director, had rented out the local theater to screen the film. And he says, you know, this is my thing. I just want to watch it by myself. It's such a personal thing, and it's going to be really hard. And I just want to do this by myself.
Well, Robert Zemeckis, also the director of the film Forrest Gump, that is very dear to Georgians, having been filmed here. But you got written out of the film. So what do you get out of this? I mean, you've been documenting the work of another extremely reclusive artist. His name is Randy Jones. He's Randy S. Jones, sorry, from Augusta, Georgia. I mean, are you that guy that goes around talking to people who make art that other people wouldn't notice?
You know, it sounds like I'm kind of stalking people, and I probably am when I tell the story, but it's almost like I just have a curiosity and I have a knack, and I just follow through with it. That one day when I pulled over to actually strike up a conversation with Mark, he's like, "You're the first person to ever pull over and ask me what I'm doing." You know, it was like people just drive by and honk or throw beer cans at me. And you were really curious, and I felt like you really cared. And I had no idea who you are, but you seemed interested in my story. And so I think that by giving genuine trust, I'm able to hear great stories and share some ways. And, you know, and I happen to have the tools to be able to share people's stories, you know, having film and video. So why not put that to use?
Well, what a story it is, and we will leave you with music from Marwin Call from the documentary film by Jeff Malmberg, as we thank you, David Noggle.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Noggle runs R&D Studios, the content creator in Atlanta, and he is the photographer who first helped Mark Hogenkamp's spectacular photographs reach the public. We'll put a link to those photographs at our website, gpbnews.org. And meanwhile, the new film, Welcome to Marwin, starring Steve Carell, Janelle Monáe, Leslie Mann, and others, is in theaters this Friday.
Making believe I'm talking to you. Wish you could hear what I say.